Are you ready for this? Boom! KP's back, and there's more spin in England versus India than Simon Cowell being photographed with a lady. We've also got Atherton, a review of the man. Compton, how's he doing? Cricket songs, and we critique the cricket critic.
We've had some complaints this week, Ross.
Really? What's been going on?
Well, first of all, we're back after just a week.
Have they complained about that?
No, that's not
They've
what the complaint
is. Already pre-complained about this that we're doing now.
The complaints are, Ross, that your singing on the end of our episodes is too sexy.
Too sexy?
Too sexy, too smooth.
Wow.
And people have been writing in from across the globe, and they're saying, can you just dial it down
Dial it down just a little bit, because it's too sexy. Is it something, are they got kids listening, maybe? Maybe a whole family crowds around in India?
They're rating us at the moment. We were PG for a while, but when you started singing...
We've just tipped over into
a 12, which is just taking out some of our audience.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry, guys.
So much to discuss this week.
Yeah,
just your apologies.
No, I'm going to turn down the sex in the whole show, in fact. I'm going to make it the whole thing up, at least 2 degrees less sexy.
Okay.
Can you feel it?
Yep, I can feel it. It's positively frigid in here. Oh. England, India. The second test, a glorious victory for England.
Absolutely.
By 10 incredible. Wickets. First test, of course, having lost by so many wickets, and then 10 wicket win. Made me think that supporting England is a little bit like being really in love with a woman. You know that feeling?
Sure.
And going out with her a long time, and she dominates your mind, and she's everything, sexually, emotionally, physically. And then one day she says, I'm happy my relationship has gone a little stale, and I think we should have an open relationship.
How so?
And if we don't have an open relationship, I don't think this is going to work out long term. So reluctantly, you agree to have an open relationship, and she goes away some nights, and you know that she's sleeping with another guy. And you try and get into it, but you don't really have that much success.
Is this something you're not telling me about?
And it's just not, doesn't really work, but you do it because you love her. And the moment she's with you, make up for the pain when she's not there. And that's what it's like when England lose by 9 wickets and then only a week later win by 10.
Wow. I really like that analogy. So thorough and emotionally driven is it. I sort of feel sick and aroused at the same time.
That's pretty standard for you, Ross.
Thanks.
Let's talk about some of the figures in the game and some of the debate. Let's start with somebody who hasn't got mentioned. Nick Compton, your thoughts?
Well, I wanted to go back to talking about him. We did before the series. And how we think so far he's settled in. I would argue pretty well, actually. He was involved in his third 50 opening partnership of 50.
It's all about partnerships.
It was all about partnerships, and if you're coming in there, as happened with Strauss, towards the end, certainly, he would lose his wicket quite early on.
Yeah.
Compton hasn't done that. He's stuck around in difficult times. You know, some would say actually coming in, you'd better be opening the batting, because at least you're not coming in with 5 men around the bat and a spinner on. You might face a few overs of seam. Nevertheless, he's come on, he's played, he's been involved in big partnerships, he got a nice 30 not out, and he actually is averaging about 37.
He is aggressive. I think there's a paradox, though. Strauss couldn't buy a run, and Trott was effectively acting as an opener.
Mm.
Now they've got an opener that can hang on for more than 10 overs. Mm. Trott can't buy a run.
Yeah.
What does that tell you? Does that tell you Trott should be opening?
No, it tells me more about Jonathan Trott's form, I think. He's just been a little off colour for a while. We love Trotty. Actually, don't have any doubt that at some point he will be back.
No, nor me. Strange that. Yeah. But no, nor me. Not a moment.
Not a moment's pause for that. But Nick Compton, I think he's doing pretty well. You know, nothing to go crazy about. He hasn't made 50 yet, but he's been quite an important part of the top of the order. Can be quite a lot of uncertainty after a captain and a guy that's been in the team for so long.
Well, aggressive retired. In that. When England had to knock off that total and the shackles were off, aggressive he was. A 6.
Really?
For
that's exactly, which immediately tells you he's a little bit more attacking than Trott. I mean, he really can dig in. Trott scored how many sixes in his test career? None, I think.
Is it zero?
I believe it's zero.
Wow.
But
they were asking Boycott the other day, how many sixes did you score in his test career? And I was convinced it was going to be zero, but it was more than zero.
It was about three or something.
Yeah. You know what's interesting about Compton as well is I feel like this is a tour for him to get through. Mm. That he is such a technically correct player that New Zealand can be his place. Mm. England at the beginning of the summer in the wet can be his place. Compton is a man for all seasons. He's the Thomas Moore of the England cricket team, isn't he?
He really is. I'm glad you put it like that. That was exactly what I was about to say.
If he's Thomas Moore, let's deal with a man who's slightly more rough around the edges. The Cardinal Wolsey, if you will, of the England team. A number two to Cook's Henry VIII. And that is Stuart Broad.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of pressure on Stuart Broad at the moment.
Wolsey. The abstract nickname thereof. Stuart Broad. Well, apparently, who would you say, I don't know whether you know, is the leading wicket taker in terms of pace bowlers in world cricket in 2012?
Well, this must be the world's worst kept statistic because I know it's Stuart Broad.
Okay.
But you're going to tell me something interesting about that statistic that I hadn't heard.
Well, I believe that is purely, I mean, that's all forms of the game. Now, that's, you have to take into account how many teams do play as many games as England.
All forms of the game.
And
see, no one had said that to me. I had not heard that. Because I was wondering,
so.
Where the hell did his test wickets come from?
Yeah.
Because I missed them.
Well, for one thing, I think the only good argument maybe for keeping Broad in is that he does tend to take wickets further along during tests. I bet you have a look at test series and he's more likely to take wickets for some reason in test 3, 4, 5 than he is 1 and 2.
A perfect example of that, the quintessential Broad game, the 2009 Ashes and the Oval.
Yep.
Not only is batting in a penultimate game at Headingley, but then that winning spell at the Oval that clinched the Ashes. So yes, I think there's a grain of truth in that. I'm genuinely torn on the Broad-Finn debate. Finn picked up 5 wickets today for the England performance squad, who I think were playing Mumbai under 10s. And Finn did very well against
did
them.
He?
6
he
foot
destroyed
7,
them.
Just bowling at 9-year-olds and really knocked them over.
How
and but yeah, I'm completely torn. And I thought for a while that my hostility towards Stuart Broad, which is entirely Twitter-based, was one reason. And so I went onto Twitter to back myself up and I concluded exactly the opposite. I feel like Broad is getting a lot of crap out there and it's really not that deserved. One little tête-à-tête that I wanted to share with the listeners who maybe aren't on Twitter, although so many of our listeners are, as we know from the contact that we have with them in the email.
4Zs. Hello.
Stuart Broad says, media complain about mundane press conferences. It's because we have to give them. Because if we didn't, there would be a storm. Hashtag fact. Hashtag boring.
Yes.
I did listen to the KP interview with Alison Mitchell after the second test win. And yeah, it does make you think, God, you know, if you're gonna take that attitude, just don't give a press conference at all. We'd be better off. But in reply, Lowy, who's at Bold Mavillain, says, at Stuart Broad, your England vice captain, how's about you take a leaf out your skipper's book and let your cricket do the talking? Which is exactly what the podcast said, but we didn't have the cojones to say it to his face.
No,
he
does. Coward.
Broad responds, world test team 2 years on the bounce. Hashtag cheers, check your stats.
Oh, I like that.
Wow, fighting talk from Broad. But, you know, it's so insightful.
Fighting a lady.
That tweet is so bizarre because world test team 2 years. Is that something that you...
Well, I know that he is in that, and I'm always quite surprised that he has been the last 2 years. But you feel it's a little like not saying best wicket taker, best bowler, which would be weird to say of yourself, I suppose, anyway. But it's like going, yeah, well, check this, swimming badge, 97, 200 metres, world, you know, regional champion.
It is a slightly odd thing to say. If I was him, I would have said Wisden Cricketer of the Year 2010, which is something that Stuart Broad was.
Ooh.
And it's that makes me really concerned, because there's Finn knocking over 8-year-olds, but there's Broad with the kind of pedigree, well, family lineage. But more importantly, he was such a great player until relatively recently. Mm. He really cannot be that bad. And there's a slight hint, I think, of you've got to find something when England play so well.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's Broad.
Well, I believe he's, given the amount of overs and how ineffective he's been, I was thinking today, it's a little bit like we've been playing with 10 men. he's hardly scored any runs, and the overs he has bowled have gone for a lot of runs. That's just the fact. But it's also true, he's got great pedigree. I'm not sure he should be in the team purely on his lineage. But he has got great pedigree, and there's a reason why he's been one of our top bowlers for a really long amount of time. And as much as I like Finn, I would probably just about say it's time for a change. I can really go into that third test. Can you honestly see Broad suddenly knocking five over? And well, can you see Finn doing it?
I've got a theory, and I think we'll take a pause here, because what you said, Ross, has very, very helpfully led straight into the next topic I wanted to talk about, which is a theory about the number of players it takes to win a test game. All right.
Here we go. Stat attack.
Well, here we are. Stats to back up the fact that we're spilling, the truth-telling, that we're doing the preaching,
yeah,
if you will.
Wow, you're really throwing rhymes at me there, bad boy.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
How lyrical I am once
so
I get
lyrical.
My flow.
So I would say that, I mean, a lot of people realise, I think, during this match, you've watched much of it, that there haven't been that many England players that have turned up, but luckily a few have.
This is exactly what I'm talking about, because you said that playing with Broad is like playing with a player less. Does that matter? That just occurred to me. After the first test, there was a criticism that too few players had played well. And clearly they had, to the extent that only Alistair Cook and Monty played well. But I thought, how many does it really take to win? And I took a very unscientific little snapshot, which is the first test England-India, second test England-India, New Zealand against Sri Lanka in the first test, and then to build up on my theory, South Africa versus Australia. And the theory goes as follows. You do not need 6-7 players to perform to win a test. You need 4 maximum. I'm convinced. 3 will do it. 4 maximum. Mm-hmm. So let's have a look through. And second part of the theory is, if you've got too many players on both sides playing well, you're going to get a draw. So what I would say is, you're not going to lose if you don't turn up, but you can avoid losing if you all turn up. But to win, you need standout performances.
Wow, I don't like that stat. And 4 is exactly the number that England have had, I would say, certainly in the last Test match. And indeed in the series, we've had Swan and Panesar turn up. And KP
and Cook,
you know,
I
mean, with a little cameo from Compton, but you know, it very much a four-man affair. Yeah.
All right, move back a Test match as well. Mm. Pujara with 200, Sehwag with 100, puts him with 520. Mm. Okay, and then you immediately go there, Oja, and Yadav picks up 3 at the end. But really, 3 players win that game. Oja picks up 9 wickets.
Ashwin was all right.
There was some players doing fine, but in terms of winning the game as opposed to just performing, that's where we are. So I thought, okay, England-India, 2 games, maybe that's just India. Let's look at Sri Lanka-New Zealand. First test, Sri Lanka won convincingly, all right? And the outstanding player in that game, as we mentioned on the last podcast, was Herath. And Herath bowled extremely well.
And Randeev!
Randeev actually is not one of the players
that
I'm about to mention. Let's work our way through the game as we go along. First innings by New Zealand, and Herath not only picks up 5 wickets, but actually it's the wickets that he picks up, because let's look at the fall of wickets, and we're going to delve into the figures a little bit. New Zealand lose their first wicket at 29. They then go for 29 for 2. And 40 for 3. The next wicket falls at 130 for 4. And that's Herath taking McCullum's wicket at 68. Herath also got Flynn on 58. So he's not just taking 5 wickets. He's taking 5 big wickets. And I'd say he's the outstanding performer at that stage. Then Sri Lanka bat. Sri Lanka only get 247 in the first innings. And this is incredible. I hadn't noticed. They were 50 for 5.
Yes,
I had no idea they were 50 for 5.
They're really in trouble.
Then when you're talking about a performance, Jai Warden is 91 and Matthews is 79 is extraordinary, because they lose their 6th wicket at 206. It's a 150 run partnership. So we've got 3 players, Matthews, Herath, Jai Warden.
This is real Moneyball stuff.
Then we go New Zealand, second innings, all out for 118. Who's run through them? It's Herath again, ably supported. So I would say that's a Sri Lanka win. That's a 3-player win, that is.
Yep.
And it's the times that they're doing what they're doing as well. So second part of the theory, what does more than 3 or 4 people say? What it does is it avoids a defeat. And the ultimate example is that when you get too many players performing, it's South Africa, Australia in the first innings of their outstanding test match, which I cannot believe Australia didn't win.
I know, Faf du Plessis being one of the guys who really turned up that game on his debut, I think, at test level.
And the thing, the reason this game's a draw is because too many players are turning up. Warner gets a century first innings. Clark's get a double century. Hussey gets a century. Nevertheless, Morkel picks up five wickets. Then South Africa bat, 122 for Graham Smith, another 78 for Faf du Plessis, who gets all the runs in the second innings. And yet, nevertheless, some good bowling figures from the Australians. And then Australia again, and they are absolutely collapsing, but Hussey picks up that 54. So I'm not talking about just raw stats, but people performing at certain times as well.
So often
they're sharing it around.
And you know, people like Hussey, Faf du Plessis cashing in twice. I mean, this comes back to one point that was very well made by Mahendra Singh Dhoni, I thought. A couple of things I thought was interesting about Dhoni in that match. One, that he was that they actually asked him to recall Bairstow. Did you hear that, Andy Flower?
Yeah.
Because his dismissal count for his helmet.
Didn't do it.
He didn't do it. And to be fair, you know, I think we got lucky with one.
Yes.
With Ian Bell.
It's because Ian Bell was a cheat.
And well, I wouldn't say that's very, very strong words. I think that I think that it was a very, very weird moment.
That man was walking off the field. I mean, he absolutely knew.
He was walking.
He'd been caught out. He knew it was coming in. He was just relying on convention.
Yeah, well, you know, the game is very largely built around convention, so I can understand his thinking in that manner.
No, but what I mean is what he said afterwards was he thought that the ball had gone.
Yes.
See, that's why I'm calling him a liar. Mm. I think he would have been absolutely fair play if he'd gone, look, you caught me out, but convention, spirit of cricket, etc. Mm. But what Bell said afterwards in the in the press conference, I thought was actually not true.
Well, he thought it was called over, is what he said.
Yeah, which was nonsense to my mind.
But well, I think it was a vet. What we've never focused on, this is a real sidetrack, but is the extraordinary behaviour of the guy that saved the ball, didn't know whether he'd saved it, stared at it for 3 seconds, then ran towards it very slowly and tossed it in very much as if it had gone. I do think it was a spectacular
moment.
That was
the Indian opening bowler. Fantastic Indian opening bowler. Was that Praveen Kumar?
I'm not sure if it was Kumar.
Why isn't he in the Indian team now?
He's great. I thought he was a really good bowler, really, really good. But you know, we weren't going to get lucky one time. I think Flower thought, oh, can we get him back as well? But no, I think after a certain amount of time, there's only so many times one can be recalled back. Yeah. I myself think the Ian Bell was the correct decision. It was a bizarre moment of cricket, and it shouldn't get in the way of essentially the game of bat and ball, which had nothing to do with what happened in that moment.
All right, fair enough. What about this? What about this time?
It came off his helmet. Apparently, we can't be retrospectively calling people back all the time.
How much was retrospectively? I mean, how long was it? Patel that went in afterwards. How long had Patel been batting? By the time that they asked them to record their
I don't know that. I think it would have been straight away. But you see, sometimes you've got to sort of... Sometimes you get a bad decision and you use it and you go, look, that could have worked out better for us, but let's go. I mean, Alim Dar hasn't had the best test in this. You know?
No, good umpire, bad test.
Bad test. DRS, you know, broad a Dar review system.
Yeah. Well, Broad himself pointed out on Twitter, 11 mistakes in the first test, 8 of which would have gone to India.
Yeah, so I think he's quite right. And I do, going back to that, I do like Broadie and what he says about all that. Also, Dhoni said about this supposed making really spinning pitches, like getting them to desperately, the Indian groundsman, to make spinning pitches to help India. Well, I think Dhoni's right when he says, well, we like result cricket and we've always have at spinning pitches in this country. I think that is preferable to those fantastic, though they are, Australian games that do ultimately, inevitably end up in draws because so many batsmen cash in.
It's interesting what you say. As an outsider who doesn't know as much about Indian cricket as he should, I found what Dhoni said was surprising because, to my mind, the spin that was available in the first test was classic Indian spin, i.e. it was slow and it was low. I thought that's what Indian pitches were like and what Indian spinners were good at and what England batsmen were bad at playing. But Dhoni seemed to suggest that actually what Indian spinners thrive on are these bouncing, turning wickets that are crumbling away. And I agree with a comment that I think it might have been the Times today, but I apologise to whoever I'm quoting, who said, actually, that's a level playing field. Because it suddenly makes it as bad for both teams.
Yes.
I thought the first test was the Indian type pitch. I didn't understand Dhoni. He just won by 9 wickets. What on earth did he want?
Well, I think that maybe there's something lost in translation. That I completely agree that I think it is the slow, low stuff that England struggle with. But I think their thought was, given that we struggle with that, how will they deal if we make it a really tough pitch? I think Dhoni was responding to the overall feeling that the pitches were result pitches. and why do that? And isn't that sort of not for the good of the game? There's not enough in there for the batsman. But I love Cricket India because it does seem to churn out results every time. It's really exciting.
I would also say that generally speaking, the idea of there not being results pitches nowadays is a bit of a misnomer. If you look about the statistics of wins and draws and results, I mean, those games where both sides hit 500 in the first innings and, you know, bat out the game, even just looking at Bangladesh and West Indies, you know, two teams that made 500 in the first inning, and there's still a result at the end of it.
Yeah.
There are not many games now that go to a draw.
And long live that, I say. And if people are calling for it not to be like that, I would disagree.
Well, Donny was asking for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist, and I thought it was a strange thing to do, but nevertheless, it's all worth chatting about. Let's talk about something else now, Ross.
Go on.
Another spinner. We're still keeping on spin, but let's critique the cricket critic.
We're gonna critique the cricket critic. We're gonna critique him.
I thought you said that you weren't going to get sexy this episode.
Oh, sorry.
You said you'd dial it
down. Sorry, I tried to dial it down.
And now,
2 degrees.
Now I've got hot under the collar.
Oh, God. Well, do go on. The cricketer we are going to critique.
Something else that makes me hot under the collar, Ross. Hot under the collar. The Cricketer magazine. I subscribe. Do you subscribe?
I certainly don't.
No, good. This controversial edition this month, the December 2012 edition. I've generally been a fan of Andrew Miller as an editor. It's been a pretty good magazine.
Sure,
I've only been taking The Cricketer actually since he became editor, although I used to read it occasionally. But they've gone horribly wrong.
What have they done?
They've gone horribly wrong.
Oh, they put Warne on the front, throwing playing cards at us for
first
a start.
Yeah, Warne in Vegas, Australia's Spin King, are the World Series of Poker, and this dominates it. We have this very distressing picture of Warne, who's slightly sweaty and his blonde hair and...
It half is, the man he used to be.
He's a strange man with his lips are exactly the same colour as his face, and he's
very
staring
unhealthy.
At
you never hear someone lose weight and people go, God, they look awful.
What I really object to, yes, you know, he's really managed something
terrible.
Quite extraordinary, hasn't he? And the other thing that's odd about this, or irritating, I should say, is this is exactly the pose that he's doing on the Cricket 888, Bet 888 adverts that are on the back of all the London buses.
Oh.
So it's just an enormous sort of, just looks exactly like the advert. I don't know how they didn't pick that up going in. And Warne is basically playing poker. Well, it's called the Cricketer, not the poker.
Not the pokerer.
Yeah, God. And I was completely disinterested in almost everything about the poker and the sort of slightly basic analogy that he was a clever bowler and he's a clever pokerer.
Yeah.
It was just utterly dull in every possible way.
What a load of rubbish.
This is the only edition of the Cricketer magazine that I failed to finish.
What was it that stood in your way?
Yeah, it was just like, it was like the Berlin Wall in the middle of this this edition. And I couldn't get over it. I couldn't escape to the West Germany of cricket reviews and kit reviews and things like that. I couldn't make it because I was shot by an East German guard halfway across the wall. Just throwing that at me. Well, take it, Ross.
I can't.
So anyway, that's the Cricketer magazine. It's a shame in a way because we've never talked about it when we've enjoyed it. So
no,
maybe
only a negative context. Next week we'll critique it in a positive sense.
Okay.
If it earns it. Now we're going to talk about Mike Atherton because I'm a cricket fan. Let's talk.
That music really is cricket. We've been meaning to talk about Atherton
for a long time.
Well, almost since we last talked about Atherton in episode 4.
Oh, that's saying, isn't it? No sooner have you stopped talking about Mike Atherton.
You have to start again.
You have to start.
It's like
there's
people that paint the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. No sooner they're done, they've got to turn around.
They've got to start talking about Mike Atherton again. Just as soon as you get onto his hair, you're going to start talking about his shoes. Mike Atherton, we talked to him, I think, in a slightly... Well, it was suggested the spat between Flintoff and Atherton.
Yeah, libelous
came
way.
Up. Slightly, yeah.
Derogatory.
And it was suggested that maybe...
A bit libelous. Have you ever seen that defence in the courts of defamation?
It was a bit
libelous. Only a bit libelous.
Well, I think that's very law-specific. I think it was... You know, the suggestion maybe that Atherton might be a bit of a prude, maybe a bit of a bore. And we suggested that Flintoff was the young blood that came into the Lancashire team at a certain time. And maybe they didn't see eye to eye, basically because Flintoff was a wild man and Atherton was probably quite boring. But I've read his fantastic book, Glorious Summers and Discontents.
Oh, yes.
You've also read Opening Up, I think, which might have been included in that review.
I've read both of them.
Well,
I received them both as gifts from the cricket team. I really didn't want to talk about this, but I received them both as gifts from the cricket team and generosity, my generosity. It's very embarrassing.
Talks about a gift you received last week. This is turning into gifts I've received, a podcast by Alex O'Dell.
Oh, I didn't bring it up.
I'd just like to say, I think Glorious Summers and Discontents, he rails against the most fantastic things. He stands up and he says, I hate, I never really thought about the shame of the Stanford match until Atherton realised how ashamed we all should have been. Yes. And I agree with him. He rails against all the awful things in the modern game and in sport in general. And he's got a lot to say. And I think he's a touchstone of morality, Mike Atherton. And rather than looking at him as a curmudgeonly old fool, I'm now going to refer to him as the cricket oracle and listen to whatever he says, no matter what he's talking about.
But I think that attitude towards Mike Atherton is a perfectly fair summation.
Yeah.
But he's also a bastard.
Do you think, why?
He's just got a reputation for being a bastard, doesn't he?
I don't know.
Talking of bastards, Ross, and continuing the theme of the book review.
That's a bit libelous.
I've been working on... Oh, it was only a bit libelous.
Only a bit libelous.
I've been working on a book that I ordered just last week, having heard him during the tea interval, during Test Match Special in the first innings. And that's Ed Hawkins' book, Bookie Gambler Fixture. Fixer, spy,
bookie gambler. I can't say it. Bookie gambler, fixer, spy.
A journey to the heart of cricket's underworld.
It doesn't roll off the tongue. Is Ed Hawkins the cricket Richard Dawkins?
just virulently demanding that cricket is corrupt to its very core.
Yeah,
it's like religion.
Yeah,
the reason is everything, and the only reason are the odds.
Wow, is that what he's saying?
No, it's not at all what he's saying. He's actually a very good writer, despite the title. And I'm only 25 pages in, but it's already extraordinary and eye-opening and worrisome. And it's really talking about corruption, but recent corruption. Everyone knows about the three Pakistani cricket players. Mm. But, you know, this is stuff to do with the World Cup in 2011. Mm. This is behind-the-scenes comments from people very high up in cricket. Mm. And my thoughts so far, and I'm going to keep them relatively limited if I may, is that I have a very strong impression all the time of a bunch of people who, by virtue of being very good with their hand-eye reflexes, as in being good cricketers,
yes,
have found themselves in positions that are otherwise completely unqualified to be in. And so cricket administration isn't... People say, oh, there's too many lawyers and administrators. I think it's the opposite. Get some administrators, because these people were cricketers.
Well,
they were very good at bowling a ball.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about. they're very good at bowling a ball, but they've got absolutely no idea how to organise a piss up in a brewery.
They've got no moral reflexes, one would say.
Yeah. Controversial,
or organisational reflexes,
or no common sense, or whatever's going on. So I'm looking forward to this book. I know there's a section later on a folk hero that George de Bell is very proud of, which is Paladino, and I think we should definitely do
Tony
a feature.
Paladino.
Absolutely, the guy who told the world about Westfield and Canaria, the man who then gets transferred out of Essex down to Derbyshire, but he talks about the rotten core of that dressing room at that time.
Well,
he's a hero.
Paladino has been having a great time at Derbyshire as well.
Yeah.
In fact, I might just be able to get him on the show.
How's that? How's that possible?
It's a big claim. But we'll see. Tony Paladino, he can tell you what, he can put it on a sixpence. He's a good bowler, and I'm glad he's doing very well at Derbyshire. That's Tony Paladino. He's found his way into a review of the John le Carré-inspired title, Bookie Gambler.
One criticism of the book, just before we leave it off, the absence of an index.
Oh, okay.
I like an index. I like it to be, able to just look something up and just, you know, go straight to it.
Look, if there's any danger that this show has been too sexy, you have brought us crashing back down to earth with your review, your salivating review of the indexless book, Bookie Gambler, Fixer, Spy. So join us next time. By the way, it's... Worcestershire's flooded again, New Road. Flooded.
Terrible news. We should have led off with that.
Vikram Solanke's also left for Surrey, and another player's retired just because he's got other better stuff to do. He's going to get a job as a, you know, in the city or something.
That was an amazing story when I read that. Another great story out there is Dan Christian, the Aussie batsman, being banned.
Yeah. We should have done all this in the show.
It's such a shame. We're just
he smashed up three dressing rooms.
Three
he loves
dressing
smashing
rooms.
Up a dressing room.
He thought, should I keep playing or should I just smash up a dressing room?
And then he did. Next week, cricket songs. Tweet us.